Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about oil and trying to get a little bit better understanding about what it is that determines price and supply. Certainly, there is a great concern that gasoline has been very expensive recently. We've seen some of the highest prices we've ever seen. There's also word that we should expect high prices for heating oil this fall. And certainly, this is something that has not been lost on Congress. In fact, last week, executives from five major oil companies were called to Capitol Hill to defend their industry. There was great concern among members of Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, about high prices. For example, Pete Domenici, he's a Republican from New Mexico, said there was a growing suspicion that oil companies are taking unfair advantage. This is a quote. He says the oil companies owe the American people an explanation. The representatives of the companies, for their part, said that recent spikes in price were the result of a number of things, of long-term trends, also with lost production during recent hurricanes. They also said that their profits were no greater than those in other industries. Well, this morning, we'll try and talk about some of this with our guest here in the first hour of the show. His name is Michael Lynch. He's president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research Incorporated. It's a consulting firm that offers services to people in the industry. He has over 20 years of experience analyzing international energy, particularly oil and gas markets. He's a research affiliate at the Center for International Studies at MIT. His work has included computer modeling of the world oil market and also estimation of the economics of supply for both world oil and natural gas, including liquefied natural gas. He's also given testimony and advice to committees of the Congress and the United Nations, the World Bank, and the International Energy Agency. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome from people who are listening. All we ask is that callers just are brief, and we ask that so we can keep things moving and get in as many different people as possible. But, of course, anyone who is interested can pick up the telephone and be a part of the conversation. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Mr. Lynch, hello.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me, David.
Well, thanks for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it. I guess overall, one of the things that I was hoping to try to get a better understanding of is what are the factors that have influenced price, particularly for crude oil, and of course, therefore, the price that we pay for gasoline and heating oil and so forth over the years. And if you take a look at the graph, certainly there have been a lot of ups and downs. There, it looks as if to me that the lowest prices for oil in the post-war period came, say, around the mid-70s. And then there have been a number of other peaks for perhaps understandable reasons. The Iran-Iraq war, there was a price spike there. There were smaller spikes for the Gulf War. And then now just recently, there has been a big spike in prices starting earlier this summer. And then the hurricanes, Katrina particularly, had an impact as well. Now, I'm sure that this is somewhat complicated, but can you just tick off if you ask this question, well, okay, what's responsible for this kind of volatility, particularly when there are these big spikes? Are there major things you can point to and say, well, these really are the big factors?
Yeah, oil is like most commodities. When you have a demand boom, like an economic boom, that can cause it. More commonly, it's a supply problem, particularly war. I mean, for orange juice, it's a freeze in Florida or Brazil. But for oil, it's usually a war someplace or ethnic unrest, something like that. And that's pretty much what we're seeing now. I think the third factor, which is a bit more debatable, shall we say, is that a lot of investors have been pouring money into oil and buying up oil as an asset. And so a lot of people, and I think Lee Raymond made this point last week, a lot of people think the price is maybe $20 higher than it should be.
Hmm. And I guess I was trying to check here this morning. Do you know what the current price is?
It's up about 50 cents this morning. I'm trying to think. It's about $59, I think, for WTI, West Texas Intermediate.
Okay. And what was the highest that it hit this summer?
It was just about $70 was the peak.
So when you say it's, there are people who think that it's $20 too high, does that mean that at 70 it was 20 too high, or at 59 it's 20 too high?
Well, that at 59 it's about $20. At $40, given current inventory levels, things like that, you would normally have about $40 price.
Well, you can understand, you talked about the fact that if prices go up, that partly that is a supply problem. And I think when the representatives from the oil company were on Capitol Hill last week, that was one of the things that they were talking about. And certainly you can understand how something as big as Hurricane Katrina could have an effect. And certainly you would expect that. But it also seems that earlier in the summer, price, even before Katrina, prices were creeping up. It seemed that over from Memorial Day on, prices were creeping up, and then there was a big spike, particularly around Katrina. And that would seem that was there was nothing obvious going on at that point that would affect supply. Now, maybe within the industry, people would say, well, no, maybe you don't know there's anything obvious, but there are things going on. Then, of course, there is a war going on in Iraq, and that's been going on for some time, and that might have something to do with it, too.
Yeah, this is where you get into a debate between, say, two camps, and I think it's very common in investment. There's bulls and bears. I'm one of the bears, and I've been saying the price is too high. And, watching the arguments made for why prices were high this summer, I think what you've got is a lot of fairly unsophisticated investment analysts who are pointing to things that are not really that important, but they've been encouraging the investment in the oil sector and in what are called commodity funds. That is where you're actually buying oil as if you were buying gold coins, and I think that pushed up the price quite a bit this summer. That was more the factor pre-Katrina, but it was starting to weaken just before Katrina because people started to notice that inventories were rising and the market was weakening.
Mm-hmm. Well, that, again, if you take a look at what has happened with prices going back to the end of World War II, there was this record low, this historic low, apparently that looks like it came around 1972, maybe something like that, and then we've had a number of spikes, a big spike where the price went above $60 a barrel. At the Iran-Iraq war, then it came down fairly steeply. Again, it hit a low, it looks like maybe about 1998, that was about as low as it had been in 1972, and then has gone up again since then. So that because there's this, over time, this big up and down, I think that there's now a lot of speculation about where we are now, and should we in fact expect to see the price continue to be high and therefore price for the finished commodities, gasoline and jet fuel and heating oil and all of that continue to stay high? Or could it indeed, over the next few years, could it go back down again somewhere near historic lows or at least lower than it is now?
Well, I certainly think it could go back to, shall we say, the long-term mean, which would be about $20. The thing is that in the 50s and 60s, you had the major oil companies and the Texas Railroad Commission, everybody kind of fighting to restrain production. But as the independent oil companies went out and produced more and more in new areas, it meant that you had a gradual glut and gradually falling prices. And then you had the two OPEC crises, and they've kind of fought a battle since then. Now, recently, the big change is that you've got a lot less surplus capacity around the world. After the 70s crises, we had huge surplus capacity, so the price just found it hard to ever go up without people flooding the market again. That's pretty much changed. So there's some question as to whether you could get back to 20, but there are people saying the price will stay at 60, but I think that's just the same as people kind of trying to talk up the price of gold as an investment. I do think we're going to be back around 30 by sometime next year.
Hmm. And what would your guess, just for some benchmark for people to think about, if oil was $30 a barrel, then what would you be expecting to pay on average for a gallon of gasoline, do you think?
Sure. Gasoline, which is running now about $2.50 a gallon nationwide for regular, would be back to around $2, which is more or less the long-term norm.
Let me ask you one other quick question. It's something, though, that maybe we can get into in a little bit better depth, but I have a caller here and want to make sure I don't make them wait forever. And that is about refinery capacity. And it seems to me that one of the things that the administration has said, and the president has said in talking about long-term energy strategy for the company, for the country, that it's important that we have new refineries built. And that suggesting that part of the problem, at least the supply problem, has to do with not having enough refinery capacity. Is that particularly an issue? It seemed likely that that would be an issue with supply, but I don't know that that would necessarily also be an issue in terms of price.
It's an issue in terms of price of products, and you saw that very dramatically in September when the price of gasoline after the hurricanes moved up much more sharply than the price of crude, which is actually rational because there was lots of crude around, but you couldn't make gasoline with it because of the shutdown refineries. This is very unusual. The odds of losing this, well, I think that in the future we're less likely to see this kind of loss of refinery capacity on a regular basis. There's always problems, but the industry's been operating with, this kind of refinery capacity for a long time. So the idea that, every few years maybe you have a six-week price spike, it's not clear you want to spend billions of dollars to try to address that.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Michael Lynch. He's president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research Incorporated. It's a consulting firm that has over 20 years of experience analyzing international energy markets, particularly oil and gas. He is also a research affiliate at the Center for International Studies at MIT. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We do have someone to talk with in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Good morning. I had, ever since I was in high school, one of my textbooks, it said, there's only a limited amount of crude oil in the ground. Mother Nature isn't making it. We're going to run out eventually. I've been expecting us to eventually run out. And it was predicted that the U.S. production would peak, when was it, in the early 70s? And it did, and that was a cause of price instability then, and it's predicted that Middle East oil production is about to peak or maybe has peaked. Mother Nature isn't making anymore. We might find some, but the easy oil has been found. And we've got much more population than we did before. China is using more oil. India is using more oil. And I thought that was maybe what was causing a big part of this. But then I watched now the PBS program on Friday night. This has become our Friday night must-see TV. Initially, I didn't watch the program because I thought Friday night is entertainment, but now I really feel like I've got to watch it. And they addressed this issue of the prices. And one example that sticks out in my mind is that there are refineries that have been shut down with internal memos from the oil companies saying, in order to raise prices and get a bigger profit margin, we have to shut down some oil refineries. There was one that was doing marvelously well in California. It had nothing to do with Katrina or Rita. And the workers were really surprised when the oil company said, we got to shut this down. It's not doing so well. Whereas just very briefly before in another document that the company had produced, it was shown as having the highest profit margin. And then good old Pat Robertson, the televangelist, I'm not sure what he wants to do in the oil business, why he's not making sure that the poor get taken care of. But he wanted to buy this refinery, figuring there would be a profit in it. And he was prevented from doing so because when he applied for loans from a bank to buy it, the bank was going to give him a loan, and then the oil company exerted pressure on them and said, we'll take our business away from you if you let Pat Robertson buy this refinery and put it back in production. And Pat Robertson, they had a TV clip, of Pat Robertson saying that he'd been prevented from buying this and why, and he said, and I'll bet you that in a couple of years, oil is going to go up, gasoline is going to be up at $3 a gallon. They also documented that there have been several tanker loads of refined gasoline shipped out of this country to other countries in order to drive the price up here. And I have half a mind, and I think I just might. You can order CDs or DVDs of various now programs, and I might just send them to my senators and my congressperson. I just was so annoyed. Got any comments?
Well, let's go to the issue, the specific issue, and we'll have the guest comment on the question about whether oil companies are manipulating the supply in order to increase the price.
Well, oil companies generally, well, first of all, the price is sort of set by the market, by a whole bunch of traders. So they're kind of like, the oil companies these days are kind of like farmers who see a price and they have to take it. The question of refineries and being shut down is, if you look at the refinery business generally, and I have to admit I don't track Pat Robertson's business practices particularly, but the business generally, especially in this country, has performed pretty poorly. That's the primary reason why people haven't built refineries here. They tend to lose money. You have had a lot of refinery shutdowns in the U.S. and other countries over the past 20 and 30 years because they're trying to cut their losses mostly. I recall very vaguely that specific instance mentioned, but I couldn't say that I would be surprised to hear that it was so terrifically profitable.
Well, they have a website, so I'm going to check some of the facts on the website so I can speak more intelligently. I wasn't taking notes, but I thought it was very well documented and well researched, and I'm really, really pleased with NOW for doing the investigative reporting that they do. Thanks. I'm enjoying Alan. Look forward to hearing what else you have to say.
Okay.
Bye.
Well, let's go on to the other subject that the caller raised. That is the debate over peak oil, something that I know that you have thoughts about. And this is here, and it's something that has been come up more and more within the past couple of years, that there are a number of people who are making the argument that the oil production around the world is either at the peak or close to the peak. And depending upon who you ask, you're going to get different numbers. There are some people who say we're at the peak already. There are some people who would say, well, maybe we're looking at another 10 years, 50 years, 10 years, 15 years, maybe 20 years, but that we're going to start running out. And as the caller said, it is indeed a finite resource. And probably the person who has gotten the most attention is a man named Ken DeFays, who wrote this book, Hubbert's Peak, and he was, in fact, here on this program a few years ago when the book came out. Going back, talking about the work of a geologist who worked for Shell named M. King Hubbert, who in the 70s did indeed come up with this conclusion that U.S. oil production had peaked. His company was, Shell was real unhappy about the fact that he had said that, and that wanted him not to be talking about that. He said, well, I don't care whether you want to or not, I'm going to. And it turned out that he was right. And then some people have taken his methods and applied that to world oil supply and then come up with this conclusion that indeed that we're getting close to the peak there. Now, having said all that, you apparently don't agree.
No, I've done a lot of forecasting and a lot of work on oil supply, and I've read most of the stuff done by peak oil theorists, and frankly, almost all of it is derivative, that is, people reading other people like DeFeas or Campbell and quoting them and then going on to conclude that, you know, therefore we need nuclear power or we need ethanol or whatever. The work by M. King Hubbert was, I mean, that forecast, he actually made two very good forecasts and five or six very bad ones. Which most people don't realize. And this is, I think, some of the evidence that should give people pause, is that the peak oil theorists tend to be very selective in what they describe. They only include the data that supports what they say. For instance, they say things like, well, Hubbert was correct, therefore he's reliable. And then I say, well, your forecasts were bad. Doesn't that mean you're unreliable? Oh, no, we don't talk about that. What it boils down to, and the caller made some interesting points, for instance, that, you know, oil is finite, and there's a lot of people in India and China who still aren't using that much yet. But you have to say to yourself, is that different from what it was 5, 10, 20 years ago? You know, when exactly did the easy oil run out? And the answer is nothing's really changed in the industry in terms of the long-term outlook. You know, there's a lot of oil resources out there. You have people doing very simplistic modeling methods, the kind that, you know, undergraduates would generally get poor grades with. But they're geologists, and they don't know about forecasting, so they don't realize, you know, that what they're doing is, shall we say, something that wouldn't pass muster in a statistics class.
Well, given it, it just would seem to me as a layperson that given the level of our science that we should at least be able to come up with a pretty good estimate about how much oil there was under the ground and in what sort of forms. I mean, is there even a, is that open to question?
Yes and no. The peak oil theorists usually point to the fact that most estimates seem to say there's about 2 trillion barrels and that we've produced half of that. Most of the recent estimates are over 3 trillion barrels, and it's not really the oil in the ground they're talking about. It's the amount that's currently recoverable, which changes with technology, but also, you know, things like infrastructure. You know, if you build a road somewhere, it becomes a lot cheaper to go in and drill for oil. So when you talk about the amount of oil in the ground, which the peak oil theorists usually ignore, it's thought to be, say, 6 to 8 trillion barrels of conventional oil, and a third to a half of that is recoverable. And then there's another 7 to 10, at least, unconventional oil like tar sands and shale oil, of which only right now a small fraction is recoverable. So that, it sounds like we've actually got decades and decades of the stuff left.
So that I guess that would be my question then. Given the fact that we're using a lot now, and given the fact that we should expect, particularly China and India, as those economies develop, that demand and consumption there should go up, what are we looking at in terms of how much oil we have and how long we can continue to use it at this rate, or when we're projecting future demand, how long we've got?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the constraining factor is probably more going to be the emissions and what that does to the atmosphere. But it looks like we could continue to grow well beyond mid-century, especially if you consider unconventional oil like gas to liquids and shale oil. That beyond that, you're so far out that I think you could continue growing beyond that. But when you start talking like that, it's kind of like people in New York 100 years ago trying to figure out where they would get the oats to feed the horses.
Hmm. Well, if we'd have trillions of between 7 and 10 trillion barrels of oil that are potentially recoverable but from unconventional sources, so that it's not just a matter of drilling the hole down into the ground and having the oil come out, and that in the past one of the reasons that resource has not been exploited is the cost of developing it would be it would be untenable economically. Now, when we're looking at oil at $59 a barrel or as high as it's been, that kind of unconventional resource seems more appealing if we're looking at $60 a barrel. However, if the prices go back down to what you're arguing should perhaps be their natural level, between 20 and 30, does that then put that 7 to 10 trillion barrels of unconventional but potentially recoverable oil back in the category of economically not feasible?
Yes, except the opposite side of the coin is the cost of production. In the 70s, people moved into tar sands thinking the price of oil would be, $100, $150 by now. And when the price came down, they spent years and they brought the cost of production down so that even before the current price spike, you had booming tar sands production. You also had people starting to move into what's called gas to liquid, that is converting natural gas into gasoline and diesel fuel. Plans right now to move into coal to liquids and shale oil, I suspect, will become back burner once the price drops under 40 or so. So in that sense, yes, I think you're very right. But, when you talk about 30 years from now, the cost of producing those things may be substantially lower because people are constantly trying to figure out ways to make them cheaper.
We are at our midpoint here. I have another caller we'll get right to. We're talking this morning with Michael Lynch. He is president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research Incorporated. It's a consulting firm that provides services to people in the oil industry. He has over 20 years of experience analyzing international energy markets, particularly oil and gas. His previous work has included computer modeling of the world oil market and estimation of the economics of supply for both world oil and natural gas. He's also a research affiliate at the Center for International Studies at MIT. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We'll go next to someone in Chicago, line number four.
Hello. Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I have 2 points to make briefly before I get into the main part of my call. One is that I think global warming trumps everything that we have to say about the availability of oil. Resources and all that. Secondly, I read recently that as much as 50% of our oil plants were shut down by the oil industry over the last 10 years or so, and therefore this is the basic reason for the shortage of manufacturing plants to convert petroleum to other products, to main products for use by civilians. Now, recently I ran across a copy of an article I made of that was printed in The Nation of July the 12th, 1980. The article was written by Fred Cook, who was a veteran reporter for the old New York World Telegram, which has since gone under, and the subject of the article was the natural gas boom. He claims, and he cites a good number of sources stating that there's enough natural gas already discovered and being discovered currently at that time to supply us with the equivalent of over 1,000 years, the oil equivalent of over 1,000 years of oil. This is natural gas converted to oil. Do you have anything to say about that? I haven't seen anything more along these lines, and I'm wondering just how this strikes you.
Well, there's a lot of what's called unconventional gas. I mean, there's a lot of conventional gas. 1,000 years sounds a bit on the high side, you know, 100 years maybe. But unconventional gas in geopressurized brine and especially methane hydrates, which is a kind of crystal that you find in shallow offshore deposits, apparently that's the resource base there is just absolutely huge. But nobody's figured out how to produce it really in an economical sense right now. There's a lot of, there's research going on into that. But the other concern is that you might wind up causing undersea landslides, which would possibly cause tidal waves and such. You know, you might create instabilities by hollowing out some of these ice deposits.
Well, the article cites a number of people from the U.S. Geological Survey, and they were pretty sure that this stuff is recoverable without too much difficulty, and also people from major oil companies and independents. And on the basis of this, I believe that these reserves are being held in reserves by the people who were able to bring them to the surface, that is the large oil companies, basically, and anyone with the money to invest in producing, and that this is, and the reason for this is to keep the price of oil that we presently have on hand easily available at a high price, and then after those supplies are exhausted, then you go to the this other stuff, which is readily available.
Well, there's two problems with that. One is the industry is very fragmented, and you'd have to have a huge kind of conspiracy that would be very hard to keep.
Excuse me, you don't have to have a conspiracy. There could be just an understanding, and basically the majors control the world market, 6 or 7 producers, and that's about it. There are a large number of smaller operators, but they don't really count.
No, the six or seven producers controlled the world market up till the early 70s, and now they have a very small fraction. I mean, ExxonMobil produces less oil than Exxon did in 1970, and there's lots of national oil companies, and in this country there's a ton of independent producers. My family produces some tiny amounts of gas too. But the other thing is, if you sit on a resource like gas, if you have it and you wait for 20 or 30 years, you know, the net present value of that, when you discount the value, the cash value of that, it becomes almost worthless. It really doesn't pay to sit on a resource once you've found it.
Well, I don't know. I don't see how it becomes worthless. It's still there, available to be extracted.
Right, but if you're selling it, for instance, in 1980, when the price was about $4 or $5, say adjusted for inflation, about $8, if you had sold that and bought a T-bill at 5%, that would now be worth, you know, the equivalent of $20 or so, whereas the price of, the wellhead price of gas now has really spiked up to only about $9. Oil in the ground usually is not a good asset. It doesn't rise at the same rate as, say, a treasury bill over the long term.
Well, the purpose of keeping that gas in the ground is to keep the price of the readily available oil that they know about sky high, and keeping it growing as in the last few years.
Well, the Red Line Agreement back in the 20s and 30s, the idea there was that everybody would increase production at a fixed amount, and that would keep the price from collapsing. And, you know, the price then was well above, you know, sort of the economic price, but it was a bit below. It's about equal to about $15 now, probably. But again, it's just, you know, people have tried things like that with other commodities, and it always breaks down because people always cheat, and that's what would happen if you really had that out there. You'd see people produce, you know, the small people would start producing and the big guys would give up and produce themselves if that were true.
I hope the caller will forgive me because I've got some other callers and I want to get some other people in here. But I do want to go back to this question of refinery capacity. And he is saying that he had read something like as much as half of the refineries had been shut down over the last 10 years. We were talking earlier in response to another caller about the fact that you said that in some cases refiners had been shut down, or perhaps one in particular had been shut down because you just can't make money in that business. Can you talk a little bit more about that and some of the economics of taking crude oil and then making it into the finished product?
Yeah, you know, historically, I mean, back before, say, 1970, the idea was you made all your money producing the crude, but you didn't want to sell it into the open market and drive the price down. So you built refineries and accepted the relatively small losses. After the price spikes in the 70s, you had the demand dropped, and you had a huge surplus of refinery capacity, and profits just went you know, well, they became losses for a long time. A lot of countries had protection for their refineries. In the U.S., we had what was called the entitlements program, which essentially sort of guaranteed profits to the small refiners. So you had a lot of what were called teapot refineries just all over the country. Reagan decontrolled oil prices in when he came to office in January 1981. And I'm trying to think. I think about half of U.S. refineries closed, maybe more, in the 80s, not so much the 90s. But they were all the small ones, and actually U.S. refinery capacity is about where it was 25 years ago because the big ones are left, and they tend to get bigger over time. People, you know, as they do maintenance and they do environmental protection work, they add to capacity in small amounts. So that's you know, what's going on with the U.S. industry. The other thing is, though, the big companies tend to find that, you know, they're losing money, and from the 1990s onward, they were under a lot of pressure to close the unprofitable refineries. The last few years have been better, but as I say, in the 90s especially, companies were saying, look, this refinery isn't making money, we'll sell it or close it. And a lot of people said, well, if you sell it to a low-cost refinery like company like Valero, then they'll just go out and undercut your prices, kind of like the airlines selling their airplanes to Southwest. So there was some reluctance to do that, but most of the big majors have lost money historically on refining. A few of the smaller companies like Valero have you know, they're low-cost refiners, and they do a bit better. But, yeah, it's true. I don't think you've seen big closures in the past couple of years, but up until three or four years ago, people were still trying to close refineries to restore profitability.
Hmm. All right, let's go to Urbana for another call here, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I listened to your guest, and I, too, am taking most of my talking points from the Now program last Friday. And, for example, the refinery that the lady talked about was Shell's Bakersfield refinery, where they showed where the Shell was claiming that there were crude shortages, but their own internal documents show that it was the most profitable U.S.-based refinery. They had been up to the point that they announced, and in 1 year they were making $37 million, the year that they announced that they were going to close it down, claiming that it was unprofitable. Their own documents show that it was not unprofitable. You talk about the markets, and I think that's the real Achilles heel to the whole problem here, because the idea of a market is really very, very abstract, and I still ringing in my ears the audio tapes they had of that back in when the power companies really put the screws to the West Coast, where the traders were laughing about cheating grandmothers on their electricity bills. You talk about commodities, and commodities are what the developing world has had to offer the developed world. And for years, there's been manipulation of those markets in coffee, diamonds, and a lot of the reason why Japan caused such a high pressure over here is because they did a turnaround on us and treated us the same way that the U.S. had treated so many other countries previously. So I think you've got a very corporate industry-minded way of looking at these problems. And as an analyst, I'm not sure you're even equipped to know whether or not the industry is going to be intends to play this country pretty much like the power industry did the West Coast. And one of you analysts, predicts that, and this was also in the Now program Friday, Tim Hamilton, it was his name, I took a note on that, he predicts that the next 10 years are going to be artificially high prices, and it's all going to be the kind of thing that that we saw with the power companies in California. So I just wanted to call in and say that I think people should take what you have to say with a grain of salt and realize that your point of view is very friendly to the whole industry, and it's not likely to come up with a point of view that would include the welfare of consumers and of the country itself. And that's my contention. I'll hang up and listen to you respond. Thanks.
All right, Mr. Lynch, you want to respond?
Yeah. No, I mean, first of all, you can imagine not all the industry, but a lot of industry certainly likes the things I say, because I do believe in relatively free markets. I certainly also believe in regulation. The caller talked about the California situation, but, you know, there's a big difference between a trader or some traders or a company and the industry. I was listening to NPR this morning, and they talked about farmers committing insurance fraud, and I have no doubt that happens, but I don't believe it's a question of farmers doing it. The industry, sorry, I'm trying to remember all the threads of his comments, but you know, the industry does not go out there and try to save the country. Their job is to try to, you know, maximize profits. That's under our system. That's what we've told them to do. There are other ways we could do it. We could have price controls. We could, you know, push more for stakeholders over shareholders. The problem is most of those things don't work very well. We've had a long history, really going back a couple thousand years, of people trying price controls and in the post-war era trying to set commodity prices. And you run into huge problems with it. The industry, again, doesn't like to hear, well, a lot of people in the industry like to hear the price is going to stay high, so they don't like to hear what I have to say. But most of the industry certainly doesn't like to hear that the government is going to decide somehow to take care of consumers. And you have to think about, well, did you enjoy the 1970s when we had lots of blackouts and gasoline lines and natural gas shortages because of bad regulation? As my old boss, who was actually a defense, my old professor, who was a defense analyst, always said, you can regulate by, you can ration by price or by time. That is, you can pay higher prices or you can wait for the things. And I believe we're better off doing it by price.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. I have another column we get read to. I do, again, want to introduce our guest, Michael Lynch. He's president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research Incorporated. It's a consulting firm that does indeed provide services, consulting services to the oil industry. He's also a research affiliate at the Center for International Studies at MIT and has spent now more than 20 years analyzing international energy markets. Questions welcome. We're talking about oil and what determines price and supply. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller in Bloomington, Indiana. Next, line number two. Hello.
Hi, Mr. Lynch. Isn't it true that most of the oil prices are set right over at the Chicago Board of Trade? Is that where they have the oil auctions?
It's actually the NYMEX in New York.
Okay.
Yeah, most commodities in Chicago, yes.
All right. Well, I was thinking, if anybody would be interested, I think they let the public go into those auctions and listen. They don't let them participate in the auction, but you can stand in the balcony, can't you, and watch the open outcry auction?
Yes, you can.
So people who think that the oil companies are manipulating the price of oil should go to one of those auctions and watch the oil companies manipulate the price of oil.
That's a good point. Actually, I listen to the oil companies complain because they think the speculators are manipulating the price.
Probably are. I wanted to ask you about ethanol and about the future of the agricultural-based fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Would you comment?
Oh, sure. Okay. I found a great quote by FDR back in 1941 who said, you know, what do we need ethanol for? We've got lots of oil and gas and coal. Ethanol, you know, we have an advantage in the sense of we have good agricultural land. Ethanol is relatively expensive compared to the normal price of gasoline, that is $2, and not attractive as a straight substitute in that sense. On the other hand, it is an octane enhancer. It has, in this country especially, a substantial future to replace the main octane enhancer now, MTBE, which people dislike for environmental reasons. And so what you're probably going to see over the long run is that ethanol is going to grow until normally when you blend it, you blend about 10% of the gasoline you replace 10% of the gasoline with ethanol. So you can imagine that some years down the road we'll be using as much as 1 million barrels a day of ethanol, which is quite a lot.
Yes. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Just for a second, on the subject of oil company profits, this was one of the issues that came up in the hearings last week on Capitol Hill, and it did seem that many members of Congress on both sides of the aisle were raising this question. The 29 major oil and gas companies in the S&P 500, they're expected this year to earn $96 billion. That's up from $68 billion last year and $43 billion the year before. They're reporting record high profits at the same time that consumers are seeing record high prices. Is there any way to answer a question like, are the oil companies' profits too high?
I don't think so, any more than you can say, are farmers making too much money? except to the extent that the money is coming from taxpayers and not consumers, i.e. buying products. I think the main thing is, and the oil companies made the point last week, is, you know, not just 1 year or one quarter, but look over the longer term, the last 5 years or so. And in that sense, they haven't made that such a high level of profits. In fact, until the last couple of years, they've been under huge pressure from Wall Street because their profit rate, that is the percentage earnings, was not as high as other industries.
So do you think that there is any possibility that the Congress might indeed do anything about oil company profits, either imposing some kind of tax or imposing some sort of requirement on the companies that they – there seem to be at least wanting to put verbal pressure on the companies to take more of their profits and put that into increased development of production capacity, that is, oil refineries and so forth,
right.
That kind of stuff, and also looking for new sources. Do you think either of those things are likely to happen?
Well, you're seeing a lot of verbal pressure, and some of that's grandstanding, and some of that is, you know, you can't just walk into an oil company office and order them to build a refinery. But I think the current Congress, because it's Republican-dominated, is fairly unlikely to do anything, unless this situation continues for another couple of years, which, I think is unlikely. And again, it's You tend to think of, when you think of these short-term bubbles, do you jump in and try to pop them? And who decides what's a bubble and what's too high and so forth? It's a very slippery slope, and it gets you into deep trouble pretty quickly.
All right. Let's talk with someone here in Rantoul, not too far away. Line one. Hello.
How are you doing today?
Good.
One of the things I was kind of curious about is it seems like the price of diesel fuel has skyrocketed and not wanted to come down. And I was just kind of wondering what his views on that were, the reasoning for it. And is it because I've heard all kinds of reasons, but one of the ones I heard is, we're such a small base of consumers, the trucking industry and the agricultural industry, which is probably one of your major uses of diesel, that they're more inclined to be more advantageous towards the general consumer using unleaded fuel. And I was just kind of wondering what his opinions were.
Okay. That was one of the things that I was interested in trying to get to, as I think earlier this summer people who were using diesel were feeling a little bit better, at least, than people who were using conventional gas because the prices were lower. And then, however, just recently, there has been a big jump in the price of diesel. Why did that happen?
Yeah, when you talk about product markets, it gets more complicated a lot faster. There's a number of things that I think are going on. And, some of it is we're trying to guess at the minds of the traders who buy and sell this stuff. But partly people are wagering on the winter weather, where if you have really cold, a couple of really cold weeks, the price of heating oil can shoot up, which affects the price of diesel fuel. So there's a bit of gambling there. But the other thing is that with the changes in their environmental requirements, that is, they're saying we have to have a lot less sulfur in the diesel fuel, it's making it harder for us to buy diesel from places like China or Venezuela, where they might not have clean enough fuel. At the same time, this is a balancing game with Europe, where they use a lot more diesel fuel than we do comparatively. And so where their market is a little tight, it means that we don't drive, they may buy more from us or more from where we would buy it, like the Caribbean, bringing our prices up a bit. So it seems that you've got sort of a short-term imbalance because of these factors. I don't think it will last very long. We'll go back to the traditional ratios within a month or two.
Okay, I appreciate it. Thank
All right,
you.
Thanks. I guess I found myself wondering whether there was some sort of relationship between the spike in the price for diesel and demand for conventional gasoline, which the companies were having a difficult time satisfying in the wake of Katrina. I guess I had this idea that we have this pool of crude, and you can do some various and sundry things with it, and that if you have an increased demand for gasoline, or suddenly you want to put more gasoline in the pipeline, more conventional gasoline, that means there'll be less crude that will end up being diesel. Does it actually work that like that?
It does, although there's lags and constraints. And you saw that actually this summer was funny because for some reason people started saying they thought diesel fuels were tight, and diesel prices went up, and people cut back gasoline production, and gasoline inventories dropped sharply just before Katrina hit, which was a problem. I think it's also that if you're a commuter, it's fairly easy to save gasoline, some gasoline, you know, drive the smaller car, whereas if you're a big trucking company, you know, and your whole business is dependent, or say a company that has to deliver by way of trucks, you can't just say, oh, we're going to cut off some of our customers. It's a little harder to conserve, so that may be a factor. But like I say, when you talk about the product relationships and so forth, it gets very complex.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I know that we have heard about putting increasing pressure on the airline industry over the last few years has been the price of jet fuel.
Mm-hmm.
Why has that gone up so much?
Well, mainly because the price of crude oil has gone up
so
much. We're just now reaching, I think, jet fuel usage levels we saw before September 11th. That's a big factor. The other thing is jet fuel and kerosene are fairly close chemically. And as you head into the winter heating season in Asia, where they use a lot of kerosene for heating, that might affect it. But, yeah, it's almost entire. For jet fuel, it's just basically high oil prices.
So you think the projections for the cost of home heating this winter are going to pan out as it looks like they're going to be?
That's a good question. The government a couple years ago said prices will be normal, and they shot up, and people gave them a lot of grief. So I think they tend to err on the side of caution. I thought the price would be lower by now. It has come down about $12 or so from the peak. If the weather stays warm the next couple weeks, we could see much lower prices this winter. I think that'll be a big factor. And especially by somewhere around mid-January, I think people start looking to see how much oil there is out there, because the heating season is, you know, the refiners look about a month ahead, and they'll say, oh, my God, we're going to get stuck with a lot of heating oil. And I think that would bring prices down then, if not before. So people are going to pay more this winter, I think, but hopefully it won't be as bad as the worst projection.
All right. Well, we're going to have to leave it at that, with the promise that I'm sure we'll get at these issues again other days with other guests. Our guest here this morning, Michael Lynch. He's president of Strategic Energy and Economic Research Incorporated, an oil industry consulting firm. He's also a research affiliate at the Center for International Studies at MIT. And Mr. Lynch, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.